makes computers seem easy, but that pocket protector says otherwise. And now, it's time for Computer Talk Radio with Benjamin Rockwell.
Tons in store for you this week here on Computer Talk Radio. Marty's going to talk about the HP Smart Tank 7301 printer with automatic document feeder. Keith Amsidori, he's going to talk about Apple's new naming convention and how it makes sense, and I agree with him. Steve Kesky, he's going to be looking back at computer manuals and missing them. We've got a lot of listener questions along the way as well. On the IT Pro series, Peter asks about big signing bonuses and long lock-ins in contracts. Isaac, why are scam emails looking more convincing? Leo, he's got some battery problems with shutting his computer down. Micah, how long is his computer going to last and what can he do? Monica, why do we keep creating technology that makes us more dependent? And Luna, are crowdfunding scams a thing? And that's on the scam series. We've got, of course, all of those different items here on this week's Computer Talk Radio. And if you miss any of them, check out the podcast at computertalkradio.com. That's computertalkradio.com. You can also contact us there. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. You can also phone me anytime at 888-NERD. 888. That's 888-637-3888. Let's dive into the news. And as we move towards the streaming-only broadcast, or, well, not really broadcast, of the NCIS spinoff called Tony and Ziva, it is really going to be interesting to see how the viewing numbers are changing, and they are. As a matter of fact, in May, more people watched television by streaming it than broadcast and cable content combined. So we're talking Netflix, and we're talking YouTube, and we're talking about, yes, Paramount Plus and Peacock, and yeah, all of these different Hulu, everybody. Yeah, more people are streaming. And this isn't really that big of a surprise. It is being attributed in a number of areas to a spike in older viewers in the streaming world, but also across all of the different options that are coming to us for better signal and, yes, even better content. People have been cord-cutting for a long time. They started doing it when they realized that cable services were not offering the on-demand nor even the wonderful, beautiful content that people are clamoring for. Yes, the big broadcast names are out there, but each of them has found or developed a significant presence online through all of these different streamers that are out there. So, yes, I started streaming a long time ago. I was one of the early streamers on Netflix, but moving beyond that, 5 years ago, I completely cut the cord when I moved, and I have not been looking back at all. It's been just an amazing experience all the way along. Now, I thought that the saga of 23andMe couldn't get any stranger. 23andMe is that DNA company. You send in your DNA, they test it, they link, you know, they do all kinds of scans across it and all of that. Anyways, Ann Wojcicki, however you pronounce it, I don't know. She was the founder, or co-founder rather, and former CEO. She resigned in March after bringing the company public, after it got, yes, a value of $6 billion before all of that collapsed under the weight of a serious, complete, total lack of profits. She's now actually working to buy it again for $305 million, or about $50 million more than what another company offered to purchase it for in May. We talked about it back then. It's all up to the bankruptcy courts at this point, but one has to wonder about, is there some kind of money shell game going on? What's going to happen to all the data? Has anything changed in that entire paradigm? Is this idea still containing any kind of promise after the bankruptcy and all of the baggage that comes with it. So, okay, there's a lot of questions and we're going to start to see answers hopefully someday. But Anne, she seems to think she's on the right path. So who am I to quibble with her and her $305 million? Now, NFC, or Near Field Communications, has a new standard that's coming this fall. Now, along with this is a new range that is four times larger than before. Now, let's be clear. There were a bunch of scares of yesteryear. They said that the chips in your credit cards and your phones and all of that could be just scraped of their data by people casually nearby. Oh, yeah, that person over on the other side of the room is going to, you know, you just have to walk into this. No, you have to have major contact. And this is... this is a distance issue, and what was the old distance? 5 millimeters. Now, it's going to go up to 2 centimeters. Or actually, let me convert that into something easier for you. Under an inch. Just a little bit. It's a little bit more than 3/4 of an inch. This is going to allow for easier usage when you're using NFC for anything. If you're doing a contactless payment, you go on up and you tap your phone on down or whatever. Also, things like exchanging your information with somebody. You tap your phone against somebody else's. Or you use one of these various NFC tags, stickers, whatever. Look, this is really good. I am happy to see this increased range, as I have tinkered with these in the past, and the precision has been a little bit, not a big, huge stumbling block, but I can see where it can be. So I'm looking forward to this, and I'm going to be tinkering with this as soon as I can. Facebook has long held videos as a separate concept from Reels. The idea of a reel was up to 90 seconds of video and audio, and it was meant to take on the likes of TikTok. Now they're shifting to merge the feeds together and simplifying the process for both sides of the equation. We're talking about creators, but also, yes, those of us who consume it. So this series of changes are going to impact Facebook, but I'm wondering if this is simply tinkering rather than innovating. Facebook usage seems to be falling off in some ways by many of my friends and changing a lot of how we view social media. Is Facebook still the juggernaut? Yes, but where is this going to take us next? The good news for creators is that the process reportedly will become far more seamless than it has been. Now, moving on to TikTok, even though a ban is legal and looming, they do have another reprieve from the White House. This is part of trying to find an agreement amongst the continued stress between our country and China. It's also because there have been potential workable deals coming along to keep the estimated 170 million users happy. It's going to take some time, however, as there are also many government bodies that are going to want to chime in along the way. It's government. It's not even a matter of want. They will demand it. They will insist that they have some sort of speaking voice in it. Anyways, the likely outcome is that it will be controlled here in the United States, and ByteDance, who are the owners through China and all of how they work, they're going to keep 20% interest in the project. So a lot of the tech will be controlled here, and they will be able to guide it, but they're not going to have hands-on like they have for, well, the entire existence of TikTok. No, you're not likely to see me working up new content on TikTok, but yeah, it's still something we're going to be watching here. Another thing we're going to be watching here is that Amazon Day, Prime Day, is coming. And as I've noted for a long time, Prime Day is not a day. It's days, or Prime Days is, or are, whatever. It seems like an odd choice. Anyways, still this year, it's doubling in size to 4 days long, driving a variety of deals on thousands upon thousands of products, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're going to see a dismal evolution of even more strangely named brands hawking products that all seem exciting, but shouldn't be really on sale. They should be competing at a competitive price for being a weird name. Anyways, this announcement will likely be followed in the coming week or so by Walmart choosing a nearby set of dates. Best Buy is going to do it, and everybody else. Anyways, for the record, this year's Amazon event is scheduled for July 8th through July 11th. Coming up next, Monica, why do we keep creating technology that makes us more dependent? That'll be next here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off. You take really good care of your listeners.
Monica has a question, and it strikes at the heart of what technology is all about. Her question, why do we keep creating technology that makes people more dependent instead of more capable? Monica reached out to me at ComputerTalkRadio.com, and you can do it as well. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. Again, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Monica's question, why do we keep creating technology that makes people more dependent instead of more capable? The overall promise of technology over the last decade, no, the last couple of, no, no, hundreds of years is making our life as humans, you and I, easier. All of it, everything around, whether we go back to fire or wheel or Gutenberg printing press. This is an easy one. This is the one that really I like to utilize this as a key pivotal moment. Up until this point, when Johannes Gutenberg, developed movable type for the printing press, at this point in time, what happened was we went from where Bibles were written by hand. Somebody would sit down and copy word for word the Bible from another Bible. They would sit there meticulously crafting each letter, each word, each line, each paragraph, putting all of this information in. Now, with the movable type, along comes this ability for us to not constrain this down to the usage of one person printing off every individual page, but now we can go through and we can put in all of the letters on the page in the right order. We can double check this, and then we can print off 10, 20, hundreds, thousands of pages identical to the previous page. That was a big, huge leap in making life easier for sending out the information included in the Bible. And we've arrived at a point where we look to technology regularly to improve our lives. And in improving our lives, Yes, we all do become far more dependent on that technology. We become more accustomed to that and expecting more and more out of technology. And along the way, we lose some of our touch on what all of that was. So if you think about it, we are at the point now where they're teaching keyboarding in very early ages in classrooms rather than the handwriting. We are starting to lose cursive handwriting as a learnable skill and tool. And that is something that we're seeing little ripples on. All in all, technology is very interesting. It's like designing a car that drives itself, but it doesn't teach you how to change a tire. And obviously, convenience sells. It sells really well. It sells better than competence. Most people don't want to sit and learn. They don't want to go through a lot of the rote items that it takes to get better. They want things done for them. So when we move forward, when I start looking at some of the techs that come along and they know their portion of technology, they know how to program. They don't know how to upgrade their computer and add in more memory, add in a bigger hard drive. They don't know what it's like to build a computer from scratch. I've been in the industry since way back in the day when it was all DOS and very few people had computers. And I learned all of this along the way. But I'll tell you, even better, and it goes right into that previous item of convenience sells. And when it sells, I will tell you that tech companies are profiting. They're profiting from your reliance on that technology. If you can't fix it, if you can't modify it, if you can't even understand your own devices, what do you have to do? You have to keep paying the companies that do. You have to pay the techs that may fix your computer, or they may not be capable of it because they only learned programming. They didn't learn about building computers. This is just an example. We all should be embracing the idea of being tinkerers, of being the hacker concept of the 80s, not the hacking that you see in war games where he hacks into the military computers or anything like that. No, but the hacking of putting all of this stuff together, putting the hardware together. We should be understanding a lot more of these elements of what makes these computers so cool. What puts them together. Everybody should be able to replace memory, to upgrade their memory in their computer, to upgrade their hard drive. These are simple items. Maybe not the hard drive. The hard drive is a little bit trickier because there's a lot involved with copying data over, but let's go with the power supply. Your power supply fries on your desktop PC. It's actually really easy to get a new one. Your power supply fries for your laptop. You just buy a new one. You don't even have to go through and do anything extravagant with it. You need to be able to troubleshoot that has happened. You need to say, well, I plug in the power supply and my laptop doesn't charge. There's no green light on that power supply. Maybe that power supply is dead. I'm not even asking you to pull it apart and replace the fuse that's inside. Hopefully, the fuse that's inside of there. No, this is something that we should be able to tackle on our own. And I'll tell you that simplicity often means hidden complexity. We have gone to the level where user-friendly interfaces have hidden the true workings of the software. All of these things being locked down means that we're hiding some of that true workings of the hardware. You and I have moved to a point where it's harder and harder to figure out how these things within our technology actually function. I'll tell you that critical thinking is bad for business. It is something that is going to really hurt business, and we are moving away from that critical thinking. If you and I start questioning how things work, if you start questioning all of these different things around you, maybe you're going to start questioning the pricing. You're going to start questioning the privacy issues. You're going to start wondering about this planned obsolescence. I will tell you that I talk about this on a regular basis. I talk on both sides of the street here. I recognize it's out there. I want to bring you awareness that all of these issues are coming at us. We need to be able to discern carefully what the best path forward is for all of the issues we have with tech. And we need to move beyond the whole, oh, that's not working, I'll just throw it out and buy a new one. Yes, we've also been sold an illusion of empowerment. Things have come along like the artificial intelligence, the assistance and automation that come from these. And it feels like you've got a lot more control. It feels like you've got a lot more going on there. But they are making decisions on your behalf. And you shouldn't be trusting AI to make decisions on your behalf. You shouldn't be going. I saw an item where somebody went off to AI to ask them how to deal with their banking issues and how to plan for retirement. And I scratched my head. No, you shouldn't be doing that. AI is not capable of doing that. They can put together a lot of the different things that they've seen out on the internet through the training, through the active search, and they should be able to give you some ideas, parrot some of the things that are out there. But I'll tell you that real empowerment doesn't come from what technology does for us, but from what we understand about how it works and knowing when we're out of our depth. In this particular last case, go find a financial advisor. Let them deal with your retirement. And hope that they're not using AI. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. That's how you can reach out to me. I will answer your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Just leave a message. Keith McCedor joins me now. And Keith.
Benjamin.
Last week, we talked about WWDC 25.
We sure did.
And one of the big things that you and I talked about in advance and afterwards was the possibility you and I talk rumor mill. We talk all of this rumor mill. We just don't
broadcast about it.
Yeah, because as you like to say, we don't engage in speculative journalism or fiction. We want to report the facts. We want to be as accurate as we can. So one of the things was the new numbering convention, which you and I...
Well, let's preface this.
Go ahead. Actually, let's cover what it is.
Well, let's, before we get into that, I want to preface it because you have been super early adopter of iOS for as long as I've known you, adopting the beta version.
Yes.
And me, I have taken a much more conservative approach, which is 180
still on
degrees.
14? iOS 14?
I'm on iOS, the latest version of iOS 17.
Yeah.
On my iPhone 15 Pro Max.
Yeah.
And I see no redeeming value in going to iOS 18 at this point. That I think I'm actually going to make the leap from 17 right to 26 come the fall. But, really? But I'm going to wait for 26.1. So some bug fixes have been implemented and bugs exorcised.
I am going to wait for 26 beta 2. And the reason, because in recent years, the first, basically the 0 and the 1 beta have always been really heavy duty drains on battery. So
I never understood that about you because, you've always been very pragmatic. And I figured, I know he wants to play with the software early. Have a backup device for doing that, but don't make it your daily driver. Primary device.
No.
Let's clarify to our listeners, Benjamin, what it is we're talking about? iOS 26. How are we getting from 18 to 26? Over the summer.
Yeah. Well, it's not even that. It is Mac OS 26. It's TV OS 26. Even Watch OS is skipping from whatever versions on 8, 9, 10.
11.
11 to 26.
And Vision OS is going from Vision OS 2 to 26.
Yeah. Now, I like this. And the reason why I like this is, Microsoft.
It unifies things.
Yeah, well, it unifies things. Microsoft, years ago, we had Windows 95, Windows 98, and then they did a crazy sidestep. They went Windows 2000 for the business operating system, and Windows ME, and then kind of lost their way and went back into all of these different. So we went with two letters last time, ME. So now let's do XP. And then, we want to give a brand new idea. So they went into Vista, then 7, back to numbers again, 7, and then 8, and then 8.1, skipped over 9.
Which is oddly enough what Apple did with the iPhone. They went 7, 8, skipped over 9 and went right to Roman numeral 10.
Does everybody have like this thing against 9? I don't know. I really appreciate, especially when they have a release every year,
right,
that they're doing this. I also like the fact that it kind of matches up with the idea of what we do with cars.
Exactly.
And we can now, in 10 years' time, we can easily date which operating system somebody's on. Oh, it's 3 years old versus remembering, Snow Leopard is 10.7. And I have no idea if I got that one right.
I mean, even me now professionally as an Apple consultant, I use an app called Mac Tracker, which is a wonderful app, which lists every single Apple product ever made and every single Apple software ever made.
Yeah.
And if I need to know when a particular version of something came out, I have to go into the app, pull up the item, see when it was released, when it was discontinued, and this new naming convention will prevent the need to have to do that.
It's going to be very easy. And I love that. So I know that if I'm driving whatever year car, I know that it is, with very easy math, I can go, my car is 7 years old. My car is 10 years old. Whatever it is, it's just easy to do that. And I like that. And now they're bringing us back to that concept. And Microsoft, I have no idea where they're going. That's another story.
They are their own entity at this point.
Yeah, they're going to probably, after Windows 11, I'm guessing that they're going to go back to names and it's going to be, who knows?
Windows doors.
Windows, yes, exactly.
Windows Ventana.
For right now, I sometimes consider Windows 11 as being broken Windows. even though.
Oh, there you go. Windows defenestration.
Too wild.
Yeah.
So that's my approach on it. Any difference on your end?
No, I mean, I wish they'd done it for last year, so we would have started with 25. That would have been a little cooler. But
I think they should have done it years ago. I this is something that should have been done back when Steve Jobs was in charge. I really think that that approach would have been far better, far simpler. I mean, you look at the iPhone series, other than skipping 9, okay, and then going to 10, which is X, and then 10R, which is XR, and I get mm-hmm. it, Roman numerals, but I would have just stuck with years.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you, Benjamin. In fact, I wholeheartedly agree with you. It might have made things a little better had they done that sooner and taken a more unified approach to it a lot earlier. But now it's here, and we'll see how it plays out going forward.
Definitely. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Cedor.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
Website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's just one way to reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says Contact Us Today, and you'll get a variety of options there. Of course, you can check out the podcast. And I always have said this, if you've got computer questions, technology concerns, I am more than happy to help you address them. Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you've got a printer? This is...
Well, I've had printers for a long time. Now, yeah. Not as much of an anachronism as you want to tell people.
I didn't present that quite right.
I imagine your newspaper lets you cut the Sudoku out, even from the online edition, right? No, I use, like everything else, things have purposes.
Sure.
And sometimes there's nothing to replace a hard copy. Sometimes you need something that's more portable than taking even a computer with you. Want to read it on an airplane and not have it lose its charge over Milwaukee? You
know, yeah.
Hard paper and well that. Anyway, like everything else, sometimes printers fail. And I had one brand I stuck with for a very long time that all of a sudden decided it didn't need to have its controller function anymore. I was stuck spending some, you know, 16, 20 cent things to go to a UPS store or a FedEx store and print a few pages I needed to send the return back, you know, the usual stuff. I wanted to be done with that. I knew that there was going to be something better. So I searched around and, you know, big surprise, HP's in the printer business.
Really? You don't say. Yeah. I've been working on HP printers. That was one of the first laser printers I ever saw was a HP LaserJet. No numbers behind it. It was just LaserJet.
And we both wondered what's an oscilloscope company doing making printers.
Yeah.
Hewlett Packard was famous for test gear back.
Long ago.
Well, I asked HP to suggest a desktop-style printer for the office at home and, to some extent, for offices at work that didn't want to be on the community printer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I asked for my favorite features, and the one they sent, I got to say, goes beyond that. The HP Smart Tank 7301. It does two-sided color printing. It has a flatbed scanner plus a 35-sheet automatic document feeder, ADF, mm-hmm. to feed the scanner.
Okay.
The printer takes extra steps to help you go paperless. Bottle-filled ink tanks, so no cartridges, wired Ethernet or dual-band Wi-Fi or USB, remote and mobile printing and all of that. And you can scan, print. You don't have to print to paper. You can print to a file that goes to your computer. It's okay. Really,
yeah,
leaving old restrictions behind. Printing happens at 9 pages per minute in color, 15 pages a minute in black and white, at up to 1,200 dots per inch. Even borderless printing up to 8.5 by 11
okay,
on paper,
nice.
Or media. And that's with paper or media weights from 16 to 28 pounds. 28 pounds gets to be kind of thick.
It does, yes.
Yeah. It's tuned for optimum performance when you print 400 to 800 pages per month.
Okay.
So, yeah, it might take you 100 months to get there, but for me, it's a pretty good fit.
Yeah. Tax time was the last time we printed anything, and we had to do that because, well, we had problems with the tax guy that we hired.
Is that why you needed the shovels to go out to the desert with?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
But we won't talk further about that. Your brain went in a really weird direction. I didn't know how to take that one. I just, all right, go on.
I'm watching too many movies on TCM. If you want to scan, mm-hmm. well, I should mention first, for all those pages of printing, the input tray handles up to 250 sheets or 30 envelopes. The output tray holds up to 100 sheets.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to scan, you can use the flatbed or the ADF.
Mm-hmm.
It can deliver JPEG, PNG, TIFF, or PDF at up to 1,200 DPI, or make up to 99 copies at a time at up to 600 by 600 DPI. If you're working at home, it's a hassle avoider. Small office, it's a great fit, unless you're paper intensive. Even in a big office, there are some papers you don't want accessible in the group printer, like maybe HR, medical, financial, or confidential documents that this printer lets you keep behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
It's my new favorite all-in-one, the HP Smart Tank 7301 printer with ADF. It's about $280 online.
I'm kind of liking the specs on that. If you're dealing with something where you're doing 20 to 40 pages a day, business day, then or under, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And that's kind of translating that 400 to 800 that you were saying before. That's a good thing.
And let me just say, I like it very much.
I'm also digging on the whole idea of the ink tanks that you were describing.
Because
a lot of different companies have really tried to lock us into those cartridges, and I'm not happy with that approach at all.
No, I have to tell you, when that other printer failed, I had to throw cartridges away that I think they were $60 for the kit when I bought them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That always hurts.
Yeah, not loving it.
As for now, that's Marty Winston. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade. But I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do.
These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. And Luna had a question for me. Are crowdfunding scams a thing? What should I look for? And there's a lot to unpack in this question. I will tell you that, yes, over the course of the years, we have had a number of different people who have gone forward and they've crowdfunded things and they were very successful and they were very much not a scam. I will tell you, I loved my Pebble watch from way back when. And there were a couple of other things where, yes, I saw success in the crowdfund world, the Kickstarter world. There have been many that have fallen apart. Fortunately, Kickstarter and a lot of the crowdfunding organizations that are for products, they set it up so that things are in escrow and you can get your money back if they don't succeed and all of that. Great. Beautiful idea. Now, there are other things like GoFundMe. And GoFundMe is the concept of, hey, so-and-so is having a problem. So-and-so wants to go ahead and build a venture, and so-and-so wants to do this. And they're looking, as panhandlers, they're looking with their hand out, hoping for money. And when we get into something that is a little bit more nebulous, a little bit more just out there, but yeah, it can go tricky very fast. And, you know, I have to treat it like this. And this is in the what should I look for? Not every sob story is real. There are people out there that just want cash. There are scammers that will create all kinds of different fake causes, and they will build up this emotional story about someone who has cancer and they're looking to collect all of this money. And this is no different than any of the other scammers who are out there and taking advantage of various tragic stories like tornadoes or hurricanes or earthquakes or whatever else that may be coming along. And they go, hey, we're collecting money for this cause, and we don't track. We don't have any way to track the money from ground zero, from point A to point B to point C, to make sure that at point C that the people who are suffering actually get the money. You have to go to places that you trust whenever you get something like this. I'm going to tell you, if you are looking to donate money for whatever cause that may be out there, I want you to look for places that are verified accounts. You're looking for transparency and updates. You're looking for platform safeguards. You're also looking for companies, not really companies, organizations that are tried and true, that we know that when things happen, that they're going on out and they're supporting the people. So you've got to think about, if you're going to donate, don't donate to some specific one person who is suffering from cancer. There's a big, huge conversation behind that. Donate to something like the Children's Hospital in that person's name. Donate something to the Red Cross in that person's name. You see a recurring theme here. You're going to kind of direct that donation and then trust that that organization is going to take things and put them to where they belong. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. TheRadioFactory.com.
Gigabyte, kilobyte, terabyte, megabyte, all this stuff makes my brain megahertz. Helping you gain the upper hand with your computer, here is Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We are halfway through this week's Computer Talk Radio. The website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. That's how you can reach the podcast. You can reach out to us as well there with your computer questions, your technology concerns. We use you to drive this into radio's broadest look at computers, technology, and how they impact all of our lives. We use all of those questions. We use every comment you make to make this a better show. Of course, you can also reach out to me at the phone number of 888-NERD, 888. That's 888-637-3888. Steve Keske joins me now, and he helps with some of the more diverse items that we've got here. For whatever reason, I was going to say divergent. That's a wrong word.
No, that's wrong. That's abstract would be better.
Abstract, yes. Now, Steve, you've been around for long enough. We go back in time, and I remember back before we started dealing with graphic user interfaces, we had to type in all of those commands.
Yep.
And the user manuals of the day back then were so important. And we had so many people who we ran into problems and they say, read the manual, read the manual. We have all kinds of different memes that are built off of that. And some of them are safe for family and some of them are not. We're not going to go in that direction. But again, it's read the manual. Wow. And that's what we had to do. Today, so much has evolved, and yes, on certain applications, we might get certain little help texts. We might get some level of a walkthrough of certain features within a program, but for the most part, we don't have manuals anymore, and I think we've done ourselves a disservice. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. As the person who used to write user manuals.
Yes, yes. You know what? I've written, I can't even begin to count how many different user documents. This is how you run this program. This is how you start this process. This is how, just.
Step one, step two.
Exactly. Yeah. And you just spell it out for people, which is, this is something that comes from, you and I have been around for so long, we know how these applications work, but also we know how to communicate a lot of this information over to people.
Oh, yeah. And when I was doing manuals way back when, the key was always write your manuals as if the person that you're talking to has got about an eighth grade education.
Wow, that was being generous. I'm kidding. I focus in that same direction, and I do utilize in Microsoft Word. It will give you an evaluation of the writing and what grade level it's aimed at.
Yeah, well, I don't even do that anymore.
No,
I expect my people to understand what I'm talking about, but. Back then, you had to really write the user manuals because those people, in the military, they did not necessarily have the education that you or I have.
Sure.
So, that's how we had to key them to the user manuals. Also, I find that you got to keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, you're going to lose the people, and they're not going to be able to use the the manual.
I like my wife's family-friendly version of keep it silly and simple, which is actually one of the things that I try to do with the documentation whenever I'm writing it. I try to add in just a little bit of that whimsy, a little bit of that lighthearted approach, especially with some of the analogies that I might throw in there to help people understand whatever it is that we're touching on. I do a lot of documents which are these days, right now, for the company I work for, the documents are one third how to do it, one third why we do it this way, and one third of different directions of where we're going.
Yeah,
and how to put this all together.
I know how you say you keep putting in a little whimsy. I know you're lighthearted.
Yes,
lightheaded.
Lightheaded, but what?
But anyway,
that's all right. Yeah,
but anyway, no. Back in the day, when I was writing manuals, because when I was writing manuals, they were all on paper.
Yes, yes.
And so you really had to say, this is step one. You finish that one. Step two, and you go on to the next. Because if you didn't put it in steps, they wouldn't understand, what do I do first?
Yeah. Very, very true. Yeah.
Very true. So that, and then we get into computer-aided instruction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which are manuals.
They are, yes.
And then you look at those and you're saying, you know, I think I'm going to have to use about the same techniques.
Sure.
Only it's going to be on the computer and not on paper.
Yeah. I've had to do a number of those over the years. I've written a number of different programs, which we needed to set up a help file for them. Because the users of those different documents, they had to be able to hit F1 for help. And the help file would come up and it would give them all kinds of different instruction. And you have to, today's words, hyperlink back and forth between the different layers of those documents.
Sure.
That made up the help file. I've done a number of syllabi. I don't know, whatever the word is for that. The multiple form of syllabus, I've done a number of those over the years, usually for a matter of 3 or 4 hours worth of training. But I remember one that was a week long worth of training. Whoa. And yeah, and this was a situation where I was training people who barely had any ability on computers to utilize some very powerful software in the real estate industry. And you and I have talked the last time I was there. That was the job that was in the late 90s. So it's quite a while back.
Quite a while back. But, you know, you talk about the syllabus and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And doing all that kind of programming or designing in users. Mm-hmm. You know, I always told my people, you know, the first thing you do, check to see if it's plugged in.
Yes. Well, you know, that's so we've. Okay. So we
that
say
goes back a long time.
We say that. And it's kind of funny because as much as we joke about that and we think nobody would ever do that anymore, we still have that same problem. Have you turned it off and turned it back on again? And usually the answer is yes, of course. But once in a while, when we're dealing with people, once in a while, that they miss that very important first step of making sure it's back in the original state.
And make sure that it's plugged into the wall. It's got, you know, it didn't come on. It didn't come on. Why? Well, you didn't plug it in. A wall.
Yeah.
No electricity, no power. Yeah. No brainers. And I've ran into that a number of times in my experience.
Yeah.
And I've had people come in and say, you know, why doesn't this work? Why does the computer crash at this time? Well, you know,
So real quick, we've got just a little bit more than a minute left. I want you to think through how many different manuals over the course of your career did you read for doing computing? Read cover to cover.
Cover to cover?
Yeah.
Very few.
Really? Okay. I figure I read about 30 to 40 of them cover to cover, and then started to learn that I could use the manuals. Yeah, maybe it was less than that. At some point, I realized I could use the manuals as reference resources.
Yes.
Much like we utilize a dictionary. We don't memorize the dictionary. No, we don't read it cover to cover.
You sit there and say, well, this is what I want to do. Well, where, look at the table of contents. Where does that, is that, they go to that chapter.
Yeah.
You know, and read that chapter and figure out, okay, I can do that.
Maybe that's why we just don't have manuals anymore. A lot of people have enough to kind of just look for what they need instead of the whole thing. Uh-huh. But that's a disservice, I think. As for now, that's the voice of Steve Keske. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and you are listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo. 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. Isaac reached out to me with a question. Why do I keep getting scam emails that look more and more convincing? Isaac reached out to me at computertalkradio.com, and he did have a couple of scams that he sent along with that, just as examples. And look, this is something that's going to continue. But the website, computertalkradio.com. Why do I keep getting scam emails that look more and more convincing? That came again from Isaac. And I want to equate this to an experience that I had many years ago. And when I say many years ago, I was a teenager. And I went to work for Knott's Berry Farm. That was the local amusement park, one of the local amusement parks. It's right around the corner from Disneyland. And during the process, they set us up for training to be cashiers. That was what I was doing. And they handed around three bills. And they said, which one is the counterfeit one? And there were people that got it right. And there were people that got it wrong. But I said, it's going to be whatever it was. They gave us three of them. And I said, it's A and C. Both of those are the counterfeit bills. I was the only one who spotted that. I was the only one that said two of the bills were counterfeit. And one of the folks that was doing the training raised an eyebrow, and the other one got this big, huge grin. Because what? Yes, they are getting better at counterfeiting currency. And some of the different bills that go around are going to be very, very convincing. Likewise, the scam emails. Counterfeiting and scam emails have something in common. They work to get better at their game. They work to get better at passing off the fraud as being realistic. And this comes from a lot of different areas. I'll tell you that they are a business. it's an illegal business. It's just like the mob. It's just like, you know, drug dealers and all the rest. They're looking to improve. And what do they do? Well, they're already dealing with computers. So they're already passing all of this information around. And one of the things that they are working on is something we refer to in the business world as metrics. They're looking for what has success and what does not. In the counterfeiting bills world, they work to pass this off to most of the people. But there are certain people that take a certain level of pride in their illegal games, and they work to make it better and better. In this scam world, these scam emails, they're doing exactly the same. And they are utilizing whatever tricks that they have that they can leverage against us. So, yes, they're looking at which emails are more successful than other emails. But they're also utilizing AI to make these scams even more convincing, to craft realistic emails, to mimic the official language and formatting. But they're also using this to insert little nuanced mistakes that would normally come from human interaction with computers. Believe it or not, they are introducing some of these to make it look realistic. Look, all of this is going through a resurgence as they realize that people are catching on to scams. So they have to make them better. People are realizing that some of these scams just, this is a scam, this is a scam, this is a scam. They're sending them off into the ether, deleting them because they know it's a scam. So what do they do to build this up? They look to improve. And I'll tell you that legitimate companies out there don't help. There are so many businesses out there that are sending their own emails. And their own emails have a pitch to them, just like the scam emails. And both these emails looking more and more identical to scams, but the scammers are looking at all of these emails, all of these different sales pitches, and they are leveraging whatever they can within those business emails, the legitimate ones, to say, I want to look more like that. And yes, they're using AI, they're using their brains, and they are moving forward with whatever they can to improve this. Now, don't get me wrong, scammers are looking at all kinds of different things. They're looking at all of the different data that's out there. They are latching onto legitimate databases. They are leveraging some of these legitimate databases out there that they achieved access through various hacks to gain the information about who is a customer of XYZ Corporation. And so then they leverage that. They leverage the information that's there to target those same customers and pretend, hey, we're the legitimate people. As a matter of fact, one of the scams I saw a little while back was one where, hey, I'm reaching out from XYZ Corporation. Your account has been hacked. We're going to have you go to this particular website, reset your password. It's all going to be good. The thing is that it was a little bit deeper than previous was they just sent these out just blanket. I will tell you, I get all kinds of scams from Bank of America. I don't have an account with Bank of America. You need to reset your Bank of America credit card password. I don't have one. They keep leveraging that concept. But now when you send it to the legitimate Bank of America customers and you make it look like a Bank of America email, including some of the very same text that Bank of America uses, well, yes, people are going to start falling for this. And I'll tell you, they're getting better at the manipulation here. They're getting better at that whole urgency issue. And most scam emails all the way along, they push this false sense of urgency. They push that whole idea of your account is going to be suspended today. But they're leveraging the same language that the legitimate emails do. because usually those have a certain level of urgency that it's going on there. So they're looking for you to act without thinking. They're looking to pull the wool over your eyes. They're looking to get further forward every time they move along. Like these are really getting harder and harder and harder. I will tell you that, yes, even some of my tech-savvy peers are starting to get fooled by these. These scams are evolving beyond the obvious typos and bad grammar, and they are moving to a level where, yes, they are written as if they are fluent in English, and they look like the real deal. They will trick even the most experienced people out there. And that is something that I'm starting to realize. Yes, I have yet to fall for one of these scams. I'll pull these up and I will say, oh, hey, that looks pretty scary. That looks, oh, hey, there's this little problem right here. Oh, this is a little odd right here. They're utilizing this particular trick or that particular trick. And this is something we're going to see get worse and worse in the coming years. So you need to go through, you need to be aware of what's going on around you. First off, you're going to double check those URLs. Whatever it is you're going to be clicking on, you need to make sure you're going to the right spot. As a matter of fact, avoid clicking in unexpected emails whatsoever. One of the big things I always tell people, if you get one of these emails, hey, you've got to reset your password. Great. Load up your browser, go directly to the usual website, bofa.com, I think is what it is, or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. You're going to go to your bank's website directly in your browser, the same way you've done every time you've gone onto your banking information for the last however many years. You're going to reset your password that way and then delete that email. Get rid of that email. I don't want that around any longer than you have to other than to take in that information and go, oh, maybe it's time to change the password. At any point in time, if you think that it's hinky, it's kind of strange, it's not really what it's purporting to be, but verify with your bank or whatever company it is directly before you take any action. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. Microcenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, Microcenter is your resource. Check out Microcenter.com today. Microcenter.com.
Micah reached out to me with a question. How long is my computer going to last? Can I make it last longer through any special maintenance or other tricks, stuff like that? And this is a common question. Micah reached out to me at 888-NERD. 888. That's 888-637-3888. In Micah's case, how long is my computer going to last? Can I make it last longer doing special things? Okay. Let's talk about this. And we need to think about our computers like just about anything else out there. If you think about it like a car, even if you drive it very carefully, there is going to be wear and tear on this, and it's going to occur over the vast expanse of time. And cars do last longer than computers. And we'll talk about that over the course of the next few minutes. And I want to tell you that along the way, you can do the regular checkups, the oil changes and upgrades and all of that. And you can keep your car running or your computer efficiently for much longer by constantly paying attention to it and taking care of these things. The lifespan of a computer and a car depends on so many different factors, but with proper care, with proper month-to-month maintenance and all of that, you can maximize its use. Now, let's talk about the first thing. What is the average lifespan of a computer? Cars, you know, we see people, the numbers right now, people are turning in electric cars after 3 years. They're turning in brand new cars after 12 years. Yeah, that's right. It's a very long turnover. With computers, it is far smaller than that 12-year cycle, and cars can last a lot longer than that. These days, cars can last 20-plus years rather easily. Computers, I'm going to tell you, right now, 5 years is probably the outside range of where you want to be. It's going to depend on your usage. It's going to depend on a lot of different things that happen along the way. How much did you pay for it up front? What style of use that you put it through, and then also a lot of just the nuances of which manufacturer. Just like there are very well-built cars, there are very well-built computers. And just like that, there are also very cheaply built cars and cheaply built computers. So you kind of have to factor that on out. My best guide for everybody, figure for it to last 5 years. If it's shorter than that, you should be prepared. You should be budgeting for replacing a computer in about, this is my general guideline, figure to budget 4 years out. If you are particularly aggressive, you're doing gaming computers or business-oriented stuff, target your budget for 3 years, see if it can go longer than that. But I'm going to suggest kind of that earlier replacement at that three-year point if you start to notice it slowing down, it's not putting out the output that you want from the computer. So, yes, they can last longer. There are people that still have computers that are running Windows 7 in professional environments. Why? I have no idea. Windows 10 is almost end of life. Windows 8, Windows Vista, all of these others, you know, you just start looking at some of these different versions of the operating system are better. Some of them are worse. You know, there are people who still run XP. Why? I don't know. But you've got the idea there. So maintenance. Regular maintenance on your system is going to be a big thing along the way. And this is usually very simple stuff. It is making sure that there isn't a whole big buildup of dust with inside your computer. And I talk about this on a regular basis, talking about our spring cleaning. We do this in the fall as well. And it's just a bunch of canned air and you blow it out. You can use a very gentle compressor, some kind of fan, stuff like that. You want most of the dust out. Do not go too aggressive. You want to update the software. All of your software should be regularly updated. And you also want to keep track of all of the different background processes, all of the different software packages that are loaded on your system. And you want to make sure that you remove out the stuff that's slowing it down, the stuff that you no longer use. And all of that is going to keep the computer running smoothly. So it's a matter of keeping, yes, your software up to date, make sure you've got malware software running, even if it is just Windows Defender. That's perfectly fine. And then you have to consider the potential for various upgrades. Some systems have moved to the point in recent years where you're not going to be able to upgrade. Some of the upgrades that you can do are a matter of add-ons through the USB port or Thunderbolt or stuff like that. So you have to think about this very carefully, both as far as what can I upgrade to right now, but also when you're buying your new system, what are my upgrade paths for the future? So some things that we may be able to upgrade still on your computer, RAM, The storage drive, you can even upgrade if you've got an older computer, but it's running what we call rotating memory or just the old spinning platters of disks. You can upgrade to a solid state drive. There are options like that that will help you out. Upgrading a video card sometimes will boost performance and extend usability. These upgrades will make older computers more capable of handling a lot of those modern software demands, but there is a certain level of maybe it's not going to be worth the expenditure. Okay, putting in a $500 video card on a computer you paid $500 for 5 years ago. Yeah, maybe it's time to replace it. Maybe that is the kind of that final straw where you need to go and actually buy a $1,000 computer, and it has an upgraded video card, but it also has a lot more memory, a lot better of everything throughout it. So you've got to think about when you're going to replace your system, and there is no right or wrong answer along the way. If your computer can no longer run essential software or updates without significantly slowing down, if the repairs or upgrades become too costly, then you might start thinking about this is the time to do it. And there is no easy right or wrong answer to this. It's going to be all about how we experience it. Even if you're computer is still running reliably, you may decide, hey, I want to upgrade because I want it to be faster. And that is also a justifiable thing. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now. Mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, sort of how they intertwine with each other. We talk about IT workers as well, and that brings us right up to a question that came from Peter, and it was more of a conversation that we had in regards to this issue of a court case off in India and how it applies to him. Now, quickly, the court case was with Vijaya. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. Vijaya Bank, and it required new managers to sign a bond. And this was kind of a signing contract. Maybe it was, it appears to be some kind of a signing bonus that went along with this. And the whole concern there was to serve 3 years or to pay roughly in our equivalency $2,400 if the managers left early. Prashant Narnaware resigned in under 3 years, and he paid that fee, but he challenged the clause. He said, basically, this amounts to slavery, and I'm bringing this down into very simple terms. And the Supreme Court of India said, no, it doesn't. This was a pre-employment contract that was made, and that the damages were legal because it doesn't actually stop Prashant from leaving at any point in time. And many U.S. employers actually offer signing bonuses in exchange for a commitment. Usually there is some kind of requirement. If you go to work for them, you've got to stay on for a year or so. And if you leave early, you must repay the bonus. And these are generally enforceable contract terms. It's part of the bonus portion. It's enticing you to stay on, but not for you to come along and say, hey, I want the signing bonus. I want, you know, $200,000 a year and $100,000 signing bonus. And then you disappear a matter of a month after receiving the bonus. If that were the case, then everybody would be going around gathering in these signing bonuses, gathering up all that they could in the terms of wealth and all of these different stock options and offerings and all of that. And the reality of this is we are not actually slaves under something like this. And there are some nuances in this. There are some certain issues where in some states, these are regulated, and they're regulated under wage laws. Overall, this is a recognized practice. There are certain situations where, yes, it can go downhill in the cases of something like liquidated damages. For instance, if actual damages are hard to calculate in advance or the stated amount is reasonable relative to a projected loss. However, here in the United States, if it sounds like it's some kind of a penalty, if it sounds like something that's punitive, is something that really nobody would ever expect, then the courts can come along and void it. Now, we've also seen some of these various contracts, along with signing bonuses, there's some kind of a non-compete, which restricts future employment. Now, some of these have been going through some legal battles recently, and we've seen some laws coming along that are restricting these, voiding them, especially if they exceed some level of reasonable time or geographic scope. Okay, so for instance, I go to work for a company, and they say, okay, we're in the aerospace industry, and if you work for us, you can never work in the aerospace industry ever again. Well, that's not reasonable. They could say 10 years. That probably is not reasonable. They could say 1 year. That could be considered reasonable. If they are only doing business in California, and I'm just, you know, choosing where I used to live, they could say, well, we only do business in California. You can't get a job in the same industry within California. You can't go to any of our competitors in California. Now, let's flip that. If I go to New York, that is no longer valid because they don't have competitors in New York. Well, maybe they do, but those competitors are not reasonable competitors. So there's a lot of different things that all kind of mold into place here. And yes, there are some level of lock-in terms, usually based off of the bonus, that initial signing bonus, but they don't really limit you. This is something I wouldn't be concerned about. This isn't forced labor. It's not trapping you in a job forever. Instead, it is offering you a chunk of change and hopefully a reasonable chunk of change in return for you spending something more than 9 months, 6 months, whatever it is with them. Can they require you to stay for the rest of your career? No, that's going to be something that they are going to have to basically face in court. Usually we're not going to see contracts like these in the United States. I've seen contracts like this with a couple of different folks I've worked with over the years. Nothing has been particularly onerous. Nothing's been particularly bad or scary or anything like this. So I wouldn't worry. I would say, yes, we need to watch this. We need to be very careful across the long haul because, yes, these things may change over the course of time. But as for today and how the laws work out right now, Peter, I think you're going to do just fine. Of course, I'm not an attorney. I don't even pretend to be one on the radio. So take this as what it's worth. Just some free commentary from a nerd. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Leo reached out with a question. Why does my computer randomly shut off even when the battery shows 40%? And this reminds me of a situation. And this goes back many years ago. And I had a car. This was one of my first cars. I'm not going to tell you what it was, but it was a car that I loved it. It was great. The gas gauge, it worked for the top half. If I had more than half a tank, I knew how much gas I had. But if it dropped down below half, the needle would just drop. You just drop into nothingness. So I always had to have more than a half a tank of gas, or risk running out of gas. And that's because my gas gauge, it lied. And Leo's going through the same kind of thing. The battery gauge is lying. And this is a situation, I'm sure he's referring to a laptop. He says, why does my computer randomly shut off even when the battery shows? Okay, so there we go. That's a laptop. So in your laptop battery, what happens is there are multiple sets of cells. And occasionally what happens is some of those cells inside go bad. The rest of them are doing fine. The rest of them can hold a good charge. But that certain set of cells, and sometimes it's like a bank of cells, it just doesn't work. So when they get older, they can no longer hold an accurate charge, or maybe in this case, no charge at all. The system just says, okay, we've got these batteries going and these batteries going and these batteries. Well, we think these batteries are going over there. And essentially, the battery calibration, for lack of a better description, is off. I mean, yes, we can go through and you can replace the battery. This is a suggestion that I have if you've got a replaceable battery on it. If it's an older system, anything older than about 4 years on a laptop, I'm going to say that the battery expense is going to be a lot more than what you want to put into it to keep it running. You do want to check into things like, is it overheating? Are your power management settings somewhat off? But there's a lot of different things we can dig into. My best guess is the batteries. And this is unfortunate. If you are looking to replace the batteries, you've got to check out the model number, the make model of the laptop. And you can look that up online. You can find out who it is that you can get the battery from. You want to make sure that you're getting a new battery. You want to make sure that it's a nice, reliable one. Do not just go on out, look on eBay for the battery, and just trust that what you're going to get is a brand new, unopened battery and so forth. Most of the laptops, I'm going to suggest a website here, iFixIt.com, and that's a great website to go to, and I suggest that if you are going to tear down any kind of system, whether you're going to be replacing the battery or hard drive or the memory, whatever it is, they have teardowns for a lot a boatload of the different systems out there. And it's more than just computer hardware. They've got cameras and cars and trucks and appliances, you name it. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. Theradiofactory.com.